Okay, ready?
Yes.
Hello, and once again, welcome to another Majesty. Yes, we are the podcast where we spill the Majesty. Do you get that play on words, Kinsey Schofield?
I love it. It's just so, it's so you. It's so wonderful.
Thank you. Very, 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 very well thought out play on words that took a long time to come up with. I'm Christo, live from London. You may know us from Talk TV because we appear on there a lot, and you can find our interviews there on YouTube. This is the podcast where we delve a little deeper into some of the big royal stories of the week, and we look back at some interesting royal stories in history. And you know what we're going to do this week, Kinsey Schofield, from the To Die For Daily website?
Well, I feel like we're going to dive into some of the most shocking royal interviews, but Christo, how many of these are with Prince Harry? Is Harry just going to monopolize this list because he won't stop talking?
Let's go further back then.
Okay,
let's go further back to when Prince Harry was nothing but a twinkle in a polo player's eye. Sorry, I mean Prince Charles's eye.
Oh my God. So bad. He's kidding. It's a joke.
I'm joking. I'm actually joking because he's the image of Prince Philip. And so I don't think anyone can joke about that anymore. But let's talk about his mother. Of course, the most famous of the most controversial royal interviews of all time. The buzz around this interview and what duplicity had to take place for this interview to happen. And I am, of course, talking about Princess Diana talking to Martin Bashir for Panorama in 1995. Now, when I talk about duplicity, I was initially referring to the duplicity, i.e. she had to sneak the camera crew into the palace. She had to secretly meet with Bashir. She had to use her brother, Charles Spencer, as a liaison
She told Paul Burrell to go home early that day. No, go home. Go see the kids. Go home. Yeah.
Funny enough, he ended up in the Vauxhall Tavern, which was strange. But of course, yes, Paul Burrell went home early. You don't know what the Vauxhall Tavern is, do you?
I have a sneaky suspicion.
Hey, well, anyway, that's where Paul Burrell ended up that night. But of course, you're quite right. But actually, the real duplicity around that interview, where, of course, Diana gave intimate details about her marriage, about the breakdown of her marriage, whether Charles was suitable to become king. Another real friend, we spoke about famous phrases last week, didn't we? Recollections may vary. Well, how about three of us in this marriage? So it was a bit crowded. Amazing. Amazing quotes from that interview, but go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm surprised at how often I think about this interview. I'm surprised at how often I think about Martin Bashir. I mean, it's like, it is so iconic. It was such a disruptor in the royal watching world, in the pop culture world at the time. It was, they say 23 million people watched this interview. I was over in America. There's no way I was going to watch. I was able to watch this at the time because, the world was different then. But yeah, in 1994, did I even have 1995? Did I even have an AOL screen name? I'm not even sure. But the world was so different then.
Were you born then?
Yes. That's so flattering. But I do think that this interview had such an incredible impact. She had to have known what she was doing, Christo.
Of course she did, but let's not also forget that the reason that she was so adamant in having this sort of interview and carrying out this sort of interview was because she wanted revenge on the royal family. She wanted revenge on Charles for the interview he'd given, which we'll talk about in a moment. But most importantly, she was trying to lash out at what she saw as the royal family spying on her. MI5 spying on her, MI5 bugging her, MI5 and the royal family doing everything that they could to undermine her. And of course, a lot of that we now know to be lies. Martin Bashir falsified bank statements. Martin Bashir falsified bank statements showing payments from being made to some of Diana's closest circle allegedly from MI5, which turned out not to be true because the bank statements were completely falsified, therefore driving Diana to want to take this revenge by giving this interview, which sort of puts the interview in a really different context, I think, because you have to now watch it through the prism of Diana thinking she's responding to something that wasn't actually happening.
I agree. I think that I disagreed with you a little bit when you were saying she was seeking revenge. To me, she was driven by fear because she felt like she was out of control. Martin Bashir is presenting her with all of these statements and documents that make her feel like the people that were hired to protect her are actually working against her. So who do you trust? To me, it was an action done out of desperation. And this is why I clash with friends like Andrew Morton and Christopher Anderson, who say it was so important that she had this opportunity to talk to Martin Bashir. These were her true feelings at the time. These were her true words. To me, it's an act of desperation. To me, she was driven by fear. And so I feel like it might not be entirely accurate when you're driven by fear and desperation.
I would say that the stuff about Camilla was a direct response, because of course in the other interview, and let's talk about this one as well now, and we'll talk about them together, in 1994, the year before, when Prince Charles had given his version of events during his ITN interview, and he admitted that he'd had an affair, and it was essentially with Camilla Parker Bowles, that being the reason for the marriage collapse, Diana felt that she needed a means to respond. And so I think the seeds went out there, the idea was put out there that Diana
she definitely responded that night, and it was in the form of a little black dress, the revenge dress.
Absolutely, a revenge dress. I mean, that's another phrase that has come. We should do one of royal phrases, one of these, right. The phrases in popular culture that have come from royal events, because revenge dress came very much from that night. And so I definitely think the stuff about Camilla and three of us in that marriage, I don't think that was driven by bank statements that were falsified by Martin Bashir.
Yeah.
That was driven by Diana. Maybe revenge is the wrong word, but certainly wanting to have her say and wanting it to be out there how this came about, how that affair came about. And so would I say that all of that interview was around Martin Bashir's duplicity? No, I think some of it was around Diana wanting her say, but certainly the means by which it came about and some of the paranoia that she displayed in it 100% came from that. And I will say one thing further. Martin Bashir has blood on his hands. Diana, I think there is an argument to say that Diana would not be dead today if it weren't for Martin Bashir, because Diana, by believing that her close protection officers that she trusted were being paid by MI5, that was one of the reasons that she actively asked to dispense of that protection, meaning that she was not with official government protection when she was in Paris, because I think if she was being looked after by MI5 or official government protection, she would never have got into that car and been involved in the high-speed chase that she was. And Martin Bashir has blood on his hands.
I mean, I think that that's a pretty fair statement. He does I hope that he carries around some sort of guilt regarding that, because, you know, you talk to Ken Ward, her former Royal Protection Guard, and he says she wouldn't have been in that car. That car had recently been in an accident. It wouldn't have been cleared for somebody as high profile as her. She would have been wearing her seatbelt. Why was she not wearing her seatbelt that evening? They would have done the pap shot, the generic pap shot. We're going to come out for 20 seconds. You're going to get the picture you want of us, and then you're going to leave us alone. There just are a million different ways he said he would have handled things differently that evening. So I think it's fair to say that Martin Bashir's dishonesty regarding the people that he said were around her is a huge reason why she cleared house and fired a lot of people and lost that protection that was so incredibly important to somebody that was as high profile as she was.
is an utterly repellent individual. Let's go back to the Charles interview, because that's another one that we are discussing. 1994, where he admitted the adultery, you know, where he gave that great pause in the interview where he said, you know, have you been unfaithful? And Jonathan Dimbleby asked him, he said, no, until it was clear that our marriage had broken down. So yeah, everyone thought, oh my God, he's not been unfaithful. Oh, okay, you have been unfaithful.
Was it like irrevocably broken or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. He made he did a very Charles phrase. I've argued a lot about this with other royal commentators that are very pro Harry and Meghan, to say that because of course there was a book that went along with this interview that was authored by Jonathan Dimbleby, where Charles criticizes his upbringing in that book. And a lot of other royal commentators have said, well, look, that's no different to what Harry's done. Now, I've always argued, well, actually, it is, because yes, there were some pages in this book that criticized his upbringing, but the point of the book was not to criticize being a royal, whereas Harry's entire raison d'etre is now to criticize anything about his previous royal life. But do you, as a royal watcher, as a royal correspondent, do you think it's a fair comparison to say, look, actually, Harry's only doing what his father did?
I don't think that Charles made a dime off that book. I will say, though, that at the time, Princess Anne, the Princess Royal, and maybe even Prince Andrew, through other people, spoke out against it and said, we had a wonderful upbringing. So this might be a little controversial, but I do wonder if the king at the time, Prince Charles, if the prince was in a really immature place to engage in that conversation, trying to make excuses for the negative public perception he was suffering through. And trying to garner sympathy, because he was at an all-time low popularity-wise when these things were happening. These were decisions being made to try to reshape the narrative and to try to garner some sympathy, to make Diana the villain, to make Prince Charles, you know, the guy who just...
Go a step further. Let's not forget, when Diana died, Charles was genuinely worried he would be attacked whilst following the funeral procession, because that's how unpopular he was at the time, which was only 2 years after this 3 years after this interview was given, 2 years after the Panorama interview, even though ironically he and Diana were on much better terms once the divorce had been finalized. They were actually in a far better place and on better terms. However, I would argue that the death of Diana for Charles's popularity was the best thing that could have happened, because no, I'm it's true. I mean, I lived through that, and Charles was an absolute pariah. But then when Diana died, there was a great deal of public sympathy towards him and the way in which he was then seen, because now we find out via Spare, if we believe it, that he was less hands-on. But he was being seen as the sort of father having to console these two sons, and was then far more sympathetically portrayed in the media. But certainly before her death, things were not going well for Charles at all when it came to public perception.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting that Harry tries to, you know, I don't know, I'd discourage us from believing that the king was around them then, because I do think that it's highly documented that Charles did make an effort to spend more time with them, taking them to Africa. I mean, it's again, I just wonder what the ultimate objective is with Harry. That's why try to just tear into your dad over something that we found so beautiful and could relate to at the time, right? Like,
let's talk more about that, because of course just 2 years ago, and this was the Apple TV Plus docu-series about Harry's mental health, another explosive royal interview we can reference. It was called The Me You Can't See. I mean, if only there was a me we can't see about Harry, but when you see every blooming part of Harry, there's no part of Harry we don't see.
Especially especially if you Google TMZ's Harry Vegas romp, you'll see plenty of Harry.
on any of him. He spoke about his family's silence and total neglect, saying, on the subject of him and Meghan, we spent 4 years trying to make it work. We did everything we possibly could to stay there and carry on doing the role, doing the job. But Meghan was struggling. And he said that he had to leave as she was going to end her life. It shouldn't have had to get to that.
Why was he talking for her in this, Christo? This is wild to me. Why is he sharing these details about her in this? Why is that his role? I mean, I don't know,
but it's funny how he's able to summon a film crew when his wife is having suicidal thoughts, but not a doctor at the time. I mean, he literally could have called any mental health doctor in the country and got her help. Yet instead didn't and waited until there was an interview. I am not undermining if Meghan was feeling suicidal or having a terrible time. That is dreadful. That's awful. I'm not denying that that's a terrible thing to go through. But I'm telling you now, if my husband, whom I adore, he makes me vodka and tonics, as you know, if he ever said to me, I am suicidal, I wouldn't say, well, come on, dust yourself off. We're going out to an event. I would say, right, I'm going to get you help.
Right.
That is the answer.
I just think, you know, coming up on the recent headlines that Harry and Meghan are pursuing separate things and going their separate ways, it's so odd to me that he would go on television to talk about her mental health and her mental struggles. You know, why is that not Meghan? I'm blown away that he would go on this Oprah Winfrey, the Me You Can't See mental health special and discuss her mental state. I just don't think that that's appropriate, but whatever. It's like, yeah, it's got to be a HIPAA violation.
I can see, but don't worry, it'll all come up in the divorce. So the other thing with Charles is that he also said in that interview, my father made him suffer. My father used to say to me when I was younger, he used to say to both William and I, well, it was like that for me, so it's going to be like that for you. He says, that didn't make sense. Just because you suffered doesn't mean your kids have to suffer. In fact, quite the opposite. Now, again, I'm going to use the phrase, recollections may vary, because that could be a very, very ruthless Prince Charles saying to his sons, you know what, I went through it, you go through it, suck it up and get over it. Or is that actually what every parent has ever said to their children, which is, well, I didn't have it this easy when I was young. You know, how many times has your mother said to you, well, I never had a computer, well, I was never allowed out till 10 o'clock, I had to be in my 7 o'clock, you know, in my day, you never had to, you know, you had to walk down to the shops and get a, you know, bag of coal and drag it home and light the fire and God knows what. But do you see what I mean? Like, it's all about context, a lot of this stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. I read that and immediately thought about all the people that I'm seeing this argument where the Supreme Court shot down Joe Biden trying to pay for everyone's student loans. You know, every argument you see on TV is, well, I had to pay back my student loans. I mean, it's the way that we communicate with each other. Him saying that, you know, I had to, I don't know. Oh. I mean, you think about what Harry did as a young man, the walking behind the casket. Unbelievable. I can't even imagine something like that happening today. It's excruciating. And I'm so sorry that both Harry and Prince William had to deal with that. But otherwise, Harry had a pretty privileged life. In what scenario was Charles saying, well, I had to do it too? Was it putting on a suit and having to go to trooping the color? Because still a pretty good day. You know, like what did you have to do that was so bad? You had a great life. And that's part of the reason why you have a hard time functioning as a grown-up in the United States of America, Harry, because you were given absolutely everything. Everything was handed to you and you didn't have a difficult life. Thank you for serving. I greatly respect that aspect of your career. But other than that, you've accomplished very little. And I don't, you know, you've, you, the reason that you're struggling to function in the United States and work a real job and to execute your promises and your contractual obligations is because you were so privileged growing up.
Yeah. And again, some people might say that's ruthlessness. Some people will just call it parenting. You know, I had to go through this. I had to, you know, again, I remember when I was younger, you know, my mum and dad saying, you have to get a job. You're like, well, why do I have to get a job? And my mum and dad, when I was growing up, I remember they were dirt poor, very, very poor when I was growing up. And then my dad started a business and he started to do better. And so, you know, me being a spoiled little brat, well, why do I have to work? Can't you just kind of give it to me? No, because I had to. So now you have to. That's parenting. That's just what parents say. That is exactly what parents say. So again, I look at that and I just think, well, actually, that makes Charles quite a good dad. Yeah. Not a bad dad, but actually makes him quite a good father. So also, he says that in that interview that he was willing to drink, willing to take drugs and try and do the things that made me feel less like I was feeling. Well, I tell you now, I want to drink and I want to take drugs, listening to that drivel. Is there anything else left to say about this Oprah interview that they gave?
No, I thought that was kind of a dud. You know, we heard about it a lot leading up to it, but there was not a lot of, it didn't make waves. I never think about this. I mean, sometimes I think about the visual of him tapping himself. Remember when he did the tapping from the Oprah and he showed how he did like that physical therapy where he tapped himself. But otherwise, I really don't think there was anything that was groundbreaking or interesting that I took away from this interview. It's a big deal because it's Harry. And it was a big deal at the time because it was Harry. But now you and I have seen up to 8, maybe 9 hours of maybe 10 hours. If you think about the Anderson Cooper interview and Tom Bradby, we've seen potentially 10 hours of Harry talking about his past. It's not as special anymore. It's not that, you know, the shine is worn off. The interest is worn off.
It makes you eye roll. Now, Oprah Winfrey, we must also talk about that interview from the same year. I know we've dissected that a lot. We spoke a bit about it last week, about the recollections may vary when it came to Kate apparently being instrumental in that phrase ending up in the statement. And let's not forget as well that a lot of that interview had some stuff in it which you either couldn't verify or was blatantly untrue. You know, that Archie and Lilibet weren't going to get titles. Well, of course they weren't, because the Queen was alive at that point. The recollections may vary, of course, coming from the accusation of a royal family member being, they were alleging racist regarding the skin colour of Archie. But as it turns out, we don't know whether that comment was made innocently or whether it was made in a sinister way. And also they called it unconscious bias anyway. So there was sort of that element, which turned out not to be true. There was also the part which Harry was saying that happened before Archie was born. Then Meghan said it happened after Archie was born, or vice versa. So there wasn't even a consistent timeline when it came to that. They got married privately 3 days before the royal wedding, something which isn't actually possible because, of course, it may have been a wedding rehearsal, but they couldn't have got married 3 days beforehand because it wasn't possible. So there were all these sort of strange parts which were either inconsistent or, some might say, completely and utterly untrue. And I think that actually picks up on your point about when you speak that much, you almost hang yourself because you expose yourself to scrutiny and people's cross-checking what you've said. And my final thought on that interview is it's very, very telling that a lot of the accusations in that interview, not all of them, but the biggest one about the baby being and the color of the baby, is not mentioned in Spare.
Yeah, I knew that's where you're going to go. I'm high-fiving you right now from Los Angeles. Yeah.
Because why wouldn't you? If that was such a massive moment. So I think they realize they dropped a clanger with that, and they realize they can't keep laboring that point because it as I said, some might say it isn't true or was completely put into a context that was manipulated to make people feel sorry for them, and actually to revisit it in Spare would have been damaging for them. Okay, let's move on from the ginge and the whinge.
Got it.
And let's talk about Fergie.
Another ginge.
Sarah Ferguson. Now, another ginge. I love Sarah Ferguson. I love Fergie because she, I kind of feel like she's clangor prone, but she's good-hearted. And let's not forget about the interview that she ended up walking out of when she was on 60 Minutes Australia. Now, apparently, interviewer Michael Usher asked her about this cash for access scandal, which had happened the year before. Now, I don't know if you remember, but in 2010, the then Fergie was stung by the fake shake. Have you ever heard of the fake shake?
Yeah, we did a great episode on this. Fergie's five, yes, biggest scandals.
Yeah, Fergie's five. The fake shake. If anyone hasn't heard that episode, go back and listen to it. But she basically offered Prince Andrew, like a rent boy, for £500,000 to anyone who'd have him. And this was access to Prince Andrew by this undercover journalist who was posing as an Arab sheikh. Well, it was all filmed. It all became this massive scandal. And then she was confronted about it on 60 Minutes Australia. She did the worst thing possible and stormed out of the interview. But then she did the second worst thing possible and returned. And apparently the interview was a very, very uncomfortable watch. I mean, my question is, how has Fergie got away with that?
How did she get away with it? I think that she, first of all, you were just saying how Harry and Meghan are talking too much and it's making, well, it's giving people more content to critique, to do their due diligence and research what they're saying. Fergie is 110% guilty of the same thing. She's sat down with Oprah. This, we're talking about a 60 Minutes interview here from 2010, but Fergie's done her own like long form interviews all over the world. I don't know, because just when the news hit that she had a much more friendly relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, the documents were released saying that Jeffrey Epstein had told his assistant, I drop everything for the Duchess. And you're realizing this is not just a relationship between Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein. Fergie is clearly close to Jeffrey Epstein as well. Right when that news dropped, we found out about Fergie's unfortunate breast cancer. So that story went away. Now we're all discussing Fergie's breast cancer and her recovery. She finds herself in pickles quite a bit, and we continue to forgive her quite a bit. I think it's
why do we find her so endearing?
I think it's she is charming, and I think she's kind, and I think maybe that's what it is.
And you got to give her credit; she has stuck by her man.
Charming, kind, and accessible. Maybe I don't know. I really don't know.
Well, you alluded to it. Let's talk about our final interview on the list, and actually, arguably, this is my favorite one. My favorite one. I love this interview. I speak a lot about this interview. I watch this interview when I'm depressed sometimes because it is just so staggeringly brilliant. And this is, of course, 4 years ago now, 2019, when Prince Andrew gave an interview to BBC Newsnight. And it was Emily Maitlis. In fact, this was such a controversial interview that the whole affair is now being made into a film for Netflix. It's called Scoop, and Gillian Anderson plays Emily Maitlis. I think Rufus Sewell plays Prince Andrew in it. And this is the interview he gave in order to clear his name over some of the accusations that he had faced of statutory rape, I think it was, and of course his interview given to try and clear his name over his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted sex trafficker and paedophile. Jeffrey Epstein has since, I think, had he died before then, Jeffrey Epstein? I think he had, actually. I think he'd turned up dead in his prison cell. It was suicide. Sorry, that was just a cough. It was suicide, apparently. And, of course, so his secrets never materialized. I mean, this interview was dynamite. But not dynamite actually because of its revelations, but also because of its absolutely spectacular misjudgment, right?
Yeah, I think that he walked away from it thinking he'd done something really good and actually went immediately reported to the queen that it went really well. According to some sources, Beatrice actually thought it went really well.
She was there. She was there while he was answering
Yeah, I
questions about
think
how
that
to
it's
accept.
just kind of really delusional. I look back on it now and I think that could have saved that family so much heartache. Honestly, the best spokesperson for Prince Andrew over the last few months or years would be Lady Victoria Hervey. She's been the only person that has made me sit back and go, should I reevaluate my opinions of Prince Andrew? But that interview itself did not.
And of course, and Virginia Giuffre, there are inconsistencies in her story about how that came about. And it's important to say that. It's also important to say that Prince Andrew, although he paid her a vast sum of money, denies any of those allegations or any impropriety. But for an interview that was designed to clear his name, I think it's rare that such an interview has not only failed to clear someone's name, but actually gone so spectacularly wrong. When asked, Emily Maitlis, who, by the way, is formidable in that interview, it's one of the best examples of interviewing, I think, ever, because she's so understated in her questioning. She gets the tone exactly right in order to lure him into speaking. She's not aggressive, actually. She's firm and she's forceful, but she doesn't make him afraid to answer, which I think is one of the brilliant ways in which she garnered so much out of him. But we heard that that not only did he not cut off ties with Jeffrey Epstein after he was convicted of being a paedophile, but he went to stay with him. When asked and pressed, why did you go and stay with him? Because I'm too honorable.
He
That's like the
likes to
kind of thing
break
you
up with
see.
people in person.
Yeah. And that's the kind of thing you say in a job interview. What are your bad things? What are the things that are bad about you? Oh, I'm a perfectionist, and I'm always too honorable with people I work with. Do you know what I mean? It's so ridiculous as an answer, rather than, oh my word, you're so right. I thought I was doing the right thing. I now realize it was wrong. But no, I thought I was right. And he's so arrogant in his expressions, where he just can't quite understand why this isn't getting through. I think the standout moment has to be the sweat and the
Oh.
fact that he knew that he couldn't have been at the place, the nightclub, I think it was, Tramps, with Virginia Giuffre at the time, because she described him, I think, as some sort of sweaty mess. And according to him, he did not sweat. And that's why he knows, because he hasn't sweated since his time at the Falklands.
Falklands. Yeah. I mean, that is probably my that's probably my favorite takeaway from that interview because it just is the most ridiculous excuse. Well, I couldn't have because this it just makes him look so guilty. The I think that it was a friend's father that said, if ever you want to look not guilty, don't give away too much information. That was just like the cherry on top. That was like this right here is making you look incredibly guilty of what you're denying.
I mean, it's the most incredible, and it led to articles. I mean, I'm looking at one now in the Daily Mirror saying 5 times Prince Andrew appeared to be sweating despite his denials. It's amazing, actually, absolutely amazing. Experts being baffled on this idea that he no longer sweats, and now being asked that he provides some sort of medical proof of this. It's unbelievable. The other one I think that was absolutely unbelievable was on one of the occasions, it might have been the nightclub one I just alluded to, actually, or there was certainly an occasion where he was placed as having been seen or photographed with Virginie Gouffre, and he was absolutely adamant. It was something like 20 years previously, and I know that it couldn't have been me with her that night. Why? Because I was in Pizza Express.
I'd never heard of Pizza Express until this interview. And now every time I see one when I'm over there, I think I almost eat there because of this entire ordeal. I mean, the fact is, it's easy to joke about Prince Andrew because, like you've said before, he doesn't feel like the brightest crayon in the box. This is not a funny story, obviously, but what Andrew contributed to the story makes it so unbelievable, and it was executed so poorly that's where the humor comes into play. You know, like, no, this is a terrible story, but he just dropped a bomb, just dropped a freaking bomb on the royal family. And to me, if you ask me where everything started to fall out for him, it would be this interview. I'm not sure he would have been. There are two things that I think sealed his fate when it comes to getting the boot from the royal fold: this interview and settling. I don't think, and I don't know if he would have had to have settled had he done this interview. So yeah, I
agree. I think this fueled the idea that from Charles and the Queen, everyone saying, right, you've had your chance. You have ruined it royally. No pun intended. That is it. Now make this go away, because you have absolutely made it a disaster. I mean, again, not only was it because he was too honourable when it came to staying with his convicted sex offender friend, it was a convenient place to stay. I mean, what kind of excuse is that? I stayed with a paedophile because it was convenient. And it was the Tramps nightclub evening where he said that he was in Pizza Express. And when it came to being photographed with Virginie Gouffre, he actually said that he didn't think that the photograph was real, even though it's been time-stamped and dated by the tabloid since. Why? Because when I go out in London, I wear a suit and tie. And because he's not wearing a suit and tie, that's why. I mean, it is just bizarre. The only thing that is more bizarre than that was when because, of course, the photo of he and Gouffre was in, allegedly taken in Ghislaine Maxwell's townhouse in London. And the only more bizarre part of this story was when her close friends decided to wear face masks and place themselves in her bath and be photographed for the newspapers in order to apparently prove her innocence, because no one could fit in the bath in order to molest someone. I mean, it's all very, very bizarre.
Oh, I'll never forget those photos. Those haunt me in my dreams. Yeah, and I've told you this story before, but in case it was on Talk TV, I'll quickly recap it. The idea that you have to go see somebody personally to break off a friendship, that was a contradiction to my friend Andrew Morton's experience with Prince Andrew. Andrew Morton wrote a book about Prince Andrew after he wrote a book about Princess Diana. And I think at the time he was the only person to have written a book about Prince Andrew. And he was at a dinner party when he met a friend of Prince Andrew's who said, oh, you've written about Andrew. Let's give him a call. I'll tell him we're together. And so the gentleman picked up the phone, his cell phone, called Prince Andrew and said, guess who I'm standing here with? I'm here with Andrew Morton. He wrote a book about you. Of course, Andrew knows that Andrew Morton wrote the salacious book about Princess Diana too. Andrew hung up on that mutual friend and never spoke to him again. So just the idea that Andrew is a gentleman and actually needs to go to end friendships in person, totally blown away by that story from Andrew Morton.
Unless they're a convicted sex offender, in which case they deserve kindness and honor. That's it. And on
Oh
that note, I
my.
think it's a nice note to end these explosive interviews that we are recapping on this episode of Majesty. What's our email address, Kinsey Schofield?
Majesty, spelled like the podcast, majestypodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you to you, Kinsey Schofield, for helping us get through this rundown and of the most explosive royal interviews of all time. There will be more, I'm sure, explosive
Oh,
royal
for
interview.
sure.
Bye bye from London.
Wait, I'm sorry. You haven't done the thing.
Shame on me.
I'm
You do
canceling
it. Why
you.
don't you do it? Why don't you do it?
Apologies to Ngozi Fulani. I don't want to mess it up. Apologies to Ngozi Fulani.
Where is she from? Oh, don't answer that. All
Oh my
right.
God. Oh my God. All right.
Hackney is the answer. He's London.
I'm Kinsey from LA. I'm Kinsey from Los Angeles. Christo
Are you
from
really from
London.
there, though, Kinsey? Are you really from LA? Where are you really from,
Oh, I'm
Kinsey?
really from Austin, Texas, which has actually become the new LA. So either way, I think I'm safe. But
Have a nice one. See you later.
thank you. Bye.